The KM Football Podcast. All the latest reaction and analysis from the KM Sports team. Listen every week and click subscribe on iTunes.
Welcome to this week's KM Football Podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Panting, and I'm once again joined in the studio by Steve Turvett of the KM Sports Desk. Our special guest this week has played at virtually every level of the game, from the Premier League down to the Isthmian League, so this is certainly an impressive CV. After spells at Hartlepool and Grimsby, he joined Gillingham in 1997, featuring in two playoff finals at the Old Wembley. His form at Priestfield earned a move to Premier League Bolton in 2001. He was back at Priestfield a year later, though, but when the Jewels were relegated from the Championship in 2005, a move to Nottingham Forest materialised. After 2 years at the City Ground, it was back to Jewels for spell number three. And although they went up via the playoffs this time as well, it was not a great personal memory for reasons that we'll come on to later, no doubt. A year at Dover, which again ended in the playoffs, was followed by 2 seasons back at Jewels as Andy Hessenthaler's right-hand man. In 2012, he became a manager in his own right at Isthmian League Whitstable before resigning over a budget dispute after 2 years at the helm. 4 eventful seasons alongside Jay Saunders in the Maidstone dugout followed, a spell that included back-to-back promotions and National League survival. His current mission is trying to keep Dover in the National League alongside Hess again, and they're making a pretty good job of it so far. And what's more, on a first for the podcast, it is also our guest's birthday. So it's a warm welcome and many happy returns to 47-year-old Nicky Southall.
Good afternoon, guys.
Afternoon, Nicky. Thanks for coming in.
Good to see you, Nicky. Normally we ask, you know, how are you getting on at your current club and all that, but given it's your birthday, we're going to have to ask, what's the celebrations? I mean, at the minute, we should paint the picture that Steve has very kindly got your little cake with only one candle on because we couldn't afford 47 of them. But, I mean, what's the celebrations going to be for Nicky tonight?
Just a quiet one, really. We got all the celebrations out yesterday as I was off and the children weren't at school and college, so we just had a quiet family meal, really. And we watched the movie, so yeah, it was good. Enjoy it, and obviously got up today ready for work, you know. And thank you for the cake.
Good stuff. I mean, let's talk about Dover first of all, and a big challenge you, Hess, and down here took on when you've got in there, but you've really hit the ground running now, haven't you?
Yeah, obviously we were brought in, and We obviously took over a club that was struggling, and not for the lack of talent. It was just, I think, a lot of it was down to confidence and fitness. And that's why, obviously, when we went in, we decided that the biggest step forward for Dover and for us as well as the squad was to go full-time training. And I think, obviously, you see the results now. It's starting to pay dividends for us.
Talk about your game at the weekend against Havant. They obviously went down to 10 men in the first half. But did you leave that one disappointed with only a point, or happy to not lose to a rival down there?
Yeah, we feel if it was a missed opportunity, you know, we feel as if it was 2 points lost. And obviously we got a point on the ball, but it was a great chance for us, you know, down to 10 men. But you see this the week previously when we were down to 9 men, it's difficult, and they're fighting and scrapping for every single point themselves. So we knew it wasn't going to be an easy game. To be fair, when it was 11v11, we were the better team, and as soon as they went down to 10 men, they dropped really deep. The conditions, I've got to say, was dreadful. The pitch cut up really bad, so there wasn't much quality in terms of football played, you know, and unfortunately we struggled to break them down, and to be honest, we had one cleared off the one of our young fullback Danny, he cleared one off the goal line. So in terms of we're hanging on in the end, and it shouldn't be like that, but listen, it's the only plus point for us, it's a clean sheet, and obviously 1 point at the end of the season, who knows, you know, it could be a great result.
What's the process after a game, Nicky? You get on the bus or in your car back home after a game, having had the draw down at Havant. How soon after that do you start planning, talking, working towards the next game, and how does the week unfold for you?
Pretty much as soon as we got in the coach, really, we talk about the game and maybe could we have changed things a little differently, or change the formation and personnel. Did we get the substitutions right? We pretty much analyse it straight away, and just through texts on a Sunday, you just never switch off, and can we do things different? Obviously the manager picked up that we weren't particularly good in the final third, so again all this week's training is going to be geared up towards our play in the final third, you know, and the boys have been terrific, they're buying into it, and listen, I mean, we've come a long way now, and we feel as if, like, you go away from home now, and we're disappointed that we've actually got points, you know, and when you go to Wrexham and you get 3 points, but we know it's difficult, and this is an unforgiving league, as many managers and coaches will tell you, it's not easy, and you're a full-time level now, you've got ex-pros coming out of the game, teams that have been up in their leagues last couple of years, dropping out. So in terms of for us, we've just got one protocol, and that is to avoid relegation this year. Everything else is a bonus, so we just need to keep doing what we're doing, continue what we're doing, and the players are delivering. And ultimately, once you go across that white line, it's down to the players and the boys that we brought in, the experience that we brought in on pitch. You know, it seems to have working at the minute, but we're not silly that a couple of defeats, you're looking over your shoulder again. So we just want to keep looking up and keep climbing the league.
Obviously, a manager has the final say at a football club, you know. But when it comes to picking the team and your tactics and planning for Gateshead next weekend, what's the working relationship like with yourself and Hess and Darren Hare? Is it like a good cop, bad cop kind of thing? Do you all take different roles within that? And is there a forum, say, if you disagree with Hess and you say, no, actually, I think we should do it this way, then you can all chip in?
Yeah, I think that's that's a good point. Obviously, with Andy, it's a case that he does listen to your opinion, and we've all got different opinions, and he will see whatever he feels fit that's going to work for the next game, you know. And we will fall out, we have disagreements, and I think it's healthy. And that's something that we, like me and Gia, used to have at Maidstone, you know. We have my opinion, he has his, and I think you need that, you know. There's no point just all being samey. I think you need different opinions.
Because you hear of some assistant managers, well, he's just a yes man, and then he does whatever the manager says, but you have to have that honesty, don't you, to be able to say, look, actually, I don't think you're right there.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great point as well, and you do that. I mean, everyone sees a game from a different perspective, whether you're sometimes even sitting high up in the stand and looking down over, you see a totally different picture from me being a player on the pitch. You see everyone from the stand goes, well, how's he not seeing that pass? Why is he not making that run? Because actually, when you're on the field, it's difficult to see the space that you have. Sometimes you have more space and less time, but It is healthy, and we all put our opinion. Even Lee now has joined us, you know, Lee Morgan, and you know, he's getting his opinions across as a goalkeeper sees it, you know. And we don't really hear that opinions too often, but it's good from a goalkeeper and someone who's experienced as he is, you know, to get them opinions as well.
How's he taken to that coaching side of it?
He's took it like a duck to water. He loves it, you know. He comes in. I've never seen him so busy, you know. He's great in the dressing room, and he's been really good for Mitch, you know. I think he's improving him all the time, especially with the ball at his feet and his decision-making. And we've got a good goalkeeper there, you know. We've got two good goalkeepers, you know. And obviously working with Wags over the years at Maidstone, and it's probably the right time. He's 35, thinking about his future, and it sort of ticked all the boxes for us.
You were part of a fair few relegation battles as a player, so you know what that's like, trying to get out of trouble. Do you think that helps? You know, you can talk to your players and say, look, lads, I've been in your shoes, and this is what we need to do to get out of it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've been a few last year deciders, and you do fall on that experience, and sometimes they go for you, sometimes they don't, but you just got to keep believing that you're going to get out of the situation. And if you're frightened of it, if you're nervous of it, you know, it just won't go away. You just got to tackle it head on and hopefully rise to the challenge. And I remember one year, I think we went to Stoke City for Gillingham away, and we had to get a draw in that game. And it had to be a 0-0 draw. If it was a 1-1 draw, we would have ended up getting relegated on goals conceded. So we went, obviously, to Stoke. There was a massive following from Gillingham fans. It was amazing, amazing experience. And to come away from that game 0-0, and they have a few chances at the end. And to be fair, we played quite well under the circumstances that was put in front of us. And at the end of the game, the scenes, as we were getting onto the bus, just was thousands of Gillingham fans. It was amazing.
I mean, I've watched those sort of games as a supporter and as a journalist, as a player. Is it equally as nerve-shredding because you know how much is at stake?
Yeah, it is. But you know you've got to be professional, you've got a job to do, because if you switch off and they end up scoring, you end up getting relegated from it or whatever, you are obviously tense. You've just got trust in your training and what your experience and your decision-making, everything. You've got to be really concentrated and, they ain't easy games, but you've got to, like I say, hopefully you need to really be connected, and the connection with the fans, and as if they're the 12th man to help you and to drive you on, you know, you just don't want to fail.
You're obviously on this side of it now as a coach. When you look back to your playing career, which manager or managers had a real big influence on your career, do you think?
As a manager, obviously, Tony Pulis, when he signed me, was fantastic for me. I was a forward-thinking player, and he got me in the mindset of thinking about, obviously, defending as well, and just the overall shape. And he was very... his training sessions were very based on shape and pattern play. And then you move on to Peter Taylor when he came in. Was more of a flair, going forward, and he had me in the mindset of getting forward. And obviously having that background from the previous years with Tony Pulis, it made a much better player out of me, because I had that defensive responsibilities as well as thinking about going forward. And obviously later on in my career, Big Sam was just amazing. You know, just opened my eyes to how you be more professional. Obviously you were professional, but just to be even more professional in everything you do, there was no stone unturned with his preparation for games, and that was fantastic to see, you know, and I really enjoyed that.
Do you think that combination of management and the influences that you've had, do you think that sort of brought the best out of you, that you did actually fulfil your potential as a footballer?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think signing for Bolton in the Premier League when I was 29, I think 29 year old, and to get a move into the Premier League at that age is probably unthinkable now, you know. And a lot of the players now are getting signed from the age of 21 to 26, but for that, to see that and have that, I mean, you think it's bypassed you. You always want to play at the highest level you can. Obviously played in the Championship for a number of years with Gillingham, you know, and Grimsby. But to get into the elite, and the elite is playing against the best players that you're ever going to come across, and to test yourself against them kind of players is magical, and it's a great honour to be on the field, and even stood in the tunnel with them, you know, and you look over to your right and you've seen Gerrard, and you're looking at Thierry Henry's, it's just fantastic. And walking out, and you're listening at Anfield, you know, to the "You'll Never Walk Alone" echoing down that tunnel. It just hairs on the back of my neck stand up now, just thinking about it.
I mean, you talk about the different things, you know, in the Premier League, the different players, but at Bolton as well, you know, when you walk into Bolton for the first couple of days, are you sort of pinching yourself, you know, is that how it was?
Obviously, I felt, obviously, coming from Gillingham, I had to try and earn their respect, you know, because they're looking at across the dressing room there and looking at who's he type thing, you know, and obviously I played a lot of games, and you got players turning up like Yuri Djorkaeff and JJ Okocha and Colin Endre, Dean Holdsworth at the time, and they're obviously looking who's he, where's he come from type thing. So I had to obviously work even harder when I got there, because I wanted to earn their respect and show them obviously I was a good player, and I did that, and I've got a really good relationship. Even now I still keep in touch with them.
How did the move come about, going to Bolton as well?
When I was at Gillingham, we played them away. I scored a free kick there. I think we ended up drawing the game 2-2 or 3-3. It was a really good game, and I think from that moment, I think Big Sam obviously was impressed, and I must have obviously had a decent game. And sometimes they just games like that stick in managers' heads or whatever, and I was out of contract, and obviously got the phone call while I was away. Funny enough, I was in Cyprus on holiday. I got the phone call, would you like to come? I was like, couldn't believe it. I was like, what a holiday this is.
We obviously have an idea of what Big Sam's like. Stuff that we see in the media, you spoke about him getting the best out of you and helping you to be even more professional. Any, you know, stories or memories of him that stick in the mind?
Yeah, I've got a few, I've got to say. some have got a bit of swear words in there, but I won't say that on the radio. But yeah, we play in a quarter final FA Cup game actually away at Tottenham, and we were 5-0 down at half time. I think Gus Poyet and Les Ferdinand. I think Les Ferdinand got a hat trick. It was a very difficult day. Anyway, we were 5-0 down at half time. We finished 5-0. So, second half, we've obviously stayed nice and compact and just ground, get some out the game type thing. So, on the Sunday, he had everybody in at 8 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday. And it's the Reebok. It's got there's like a museum at the behind one of the stands, and it's got a big theatre room, so he's got massive screen TV, and we're all sat in there, and he's put the game on again, so we're all there to sit through the game, watch it. And it's not nice sitting through games like that, because there's moments in the games and you look and go, God, could have done better. Or what. And we had a Japanese guy player for us, Okinzawa. I can't remember. Yeah. And it was 8 o'clock in the morning and he's watching it and he fell asleep. So you could imagine, he fell asleep and lights come on and he's snoring away. So Big Sam's got this big stick, because it was quite high, the TV.
Up on the projector.
On the projector. And he's walked over to him and just shouted. I've never known anything like, he just shouted down his ear. He just jumped up and we were all sat there sniggering, but you couldn't see enough. He went back to the screen and I think it was, he made a mistake for one of the goals, and he's got this big cane, he's whacked it against the TV and it just smashed. Snapped up in his hand, and he just flung it on the floor and just walked out. God, but we were all in stitches.
And
to be fair,
Bolton had just come up into the Premier League, hadn't they? And the players that they were starting to sign at that point, you mentioned people like Djorkaeff, who I think came in February of that season, and he'd won the World Cup a few
Freddie
years
Bobic.
Before.
Freddie Bobic turned up and for Germany.
I mean, being around those guys on the training field must have been amazing.
It was unbelievable, you know, and just to watch like the first touch, even like JJ Kocha. I mean, you wouldn't go near him in training for the fear of getting embarrassed by him, and so you seem to just have that 1 or 2 seconds extra on the ball, because nobody would go diving in, because he'd make a fool of you. And Yuri Djorkaeff, just watching his first touch, he could beat 2 or 3 players just by his first touch, and the awareness of the guy was just unbelievable. And to train with these people and these players and that talent, you imagine the training was just a joke. You give possession away, you were never getting it back. So he actually made you actually a better player, because you concentrate more and they give you more options on the ball. And that's one thing I found when I played in the Premier League, is everyone goes how fast it is. It's not that fast. It's when you lose the ball and you've got fast players, likes of Thierry Henry at the time, and you give possession away, they punish you. Actually, when you have the ball, they seem to just sit off you, and it didn't really close you down at the time. So people go, it's about the hardest, fastest league in the world, but actually, when you're out there, it didn't seem that way.
Taking care of the ball.
Yeah,
so important,
and you look at it now, it's all possession based now, it's quite slow, the build up. I was watching Tottenham the other day, and it's this amount of passes in the game now, it's just crazy. But obviously years ago it wasn't so much possession, it was more up it, get the ball forward into strikers, and 4-4-2, get the ball wide to winger across. And but now it's all obviously possession based, playing out from the back, goalkeepers doing what they're doing now, you know. And I mean, like I say, training was just unbelievable. And then we had Ivan Campo turned up, just come from Real Madrid.
I bet he was quite a character, wasn't he?
He was funny, yeah, he was brilliant, to be fair. He had a pot belly on him, and he was unfit. But Big Sam used to play him, and he played him at the back and then moved him into midfield, because he was so much of a liability.
Trust him in defence.
Yeah, well, nowadays he would get away with playing out from the back, but and then he moved him into just sitting in front of the back four, and he was a totally different animal, and he was brilliant.
How did you bond as a team then? Did Big Sam sort of take you out and do things? Or?
Yes, I did, yeah. We used to have all these eating challenges. If the players got so many points, then the staff would have to... The stuff that they eat, the stuff in the jungle now, like we used to go to a Turkish restaurant or a Lebanese restaurant, we used to eat all this bizarre food, and if we didn't reach our points targets, then the captain at the time, Gudney Bergson, would pick 2 or 3 players to go out with the staff, and you'd have to eat the crappy food for the on the players' side of it. So yeah, it was great, and the team bonding, it was fantastic. We went up to the Lake District, and we did an outward bound weekend when it was international break, and so all the players who weren't involved went up there. We had 3 days up there, and like basically just all sat there, and all these men just started descending from the roof on these ropes with like all masks on, and like what the hell's going on? We thought it was a terrorist attack, and basically we just got put into groups, and that was. In dormitories, and that was our team for 3 days, and we had our leaders. We had to make rafts to go across the other side of the lake. We're canoeing, we're jumping off these waterfalls, going across. It was brilliant, and it was great. And we had obviously a night out as well for all of, because obviously you've got different nationalities, and we had to. He obviously was clever the way Big Sam did it and brought us all together.
Because really, the strength of that group
was how close
together you were. So that stuff off the pitch, it really does make a difference when you get out on the football pitch playing at Anfield, White Hart Lane, wherever.
It is, and you need to build a trust with each other and a bond. You know, you want to go over that white line. I'll give everything for my teammate, you know, and if he hopefully gives everything for me, and that was, we were like a band of brothers. Nobody really wanted to play us. It was, I think it was like years ago when Wimbledon were around, it was like the crazy gang, and that's what you wanted, that crazy gang type
mentality.
Team spirit, you know, and we did, because we used to dig results out. We went to Old Trafford 2 years in a row and we beat them, and that was unbelievable. It was unheard of, you know, and we went there and beat them twice.
You'd had 4 years at Gillingham before you went up to Bolton. You came back and had another 3 for them. You know, considering you were a lad from Middlesbrough, what was it about Jules or this part of the world that, you know, really started to feel like home for you?
I think it was first when I first signed for Gillingham, coming down from North. It is a massive thing to deal with, you know. And then my children were born here. Went to nursery school, so eventually they get friends, and we all of a sudden, my wife was meeting friends of the school, and we just didn't want to move the kids around too much and go to different schools all the time. I mean, I did go up to Nottingham and I moved there, you know, but I should have really went up there and rented, and but we ended up buying up there, and I was there, like say, 2 years, but. I always knew that Kent was going to be my home, you know, and especially as the children were all born down here.
What was special about Jules as a clubman?
Again, it was one of them unfashionable clubs at the time. when I spoke to Paul Scully, he flew me down from Grimsby, and I ended up staying at his house with him, and it was like that personal touch which really sold the club to me, and it. And I've always had a brilliant rapport with the fans, and they've made me feel special, you know. And even to this day now, just walking out there, and you miss it, you know. It's even like when I'm driving past the ground, it's like my car just wants to pull in there, you know. And the great memories, got obviously promotions and Wembley, and you know everything. Obviously, I had the dark days of getting relegated last game of the season against Nottingham Forest, and they were tough to deal with, but. Overall, it was just where things happened for me, and my family, my children were born here, so I had that connection anyway.
The two finals at the old Wembley, what stands out for you about them now when you look back? You know, what's the memories in
5 minutes? That's what does me. I mean, they were brilliant finals in different many ways. To go to Wembley and not lose actually in 90 minutes is, I mean, we obviously. I was involved with the the Shrewsbury one, obviously I wasn't on the bench and this, that and the other. Obviously I had me ups and downs with Mr. Stimson, but overall, the Man City one, we were the massive underdogs. Unfashionable club. It was, I think, the biggest record crowd against, obviously, Man City, the big players in the league, and to go 2-0 up, and we were cruising, I've got to say. And unfortunately, we made a few substitutions that probably turned the game. You know, we take two strikers off and put two defenders on, and it was just backs against the wall for the last 5-10 minutes, and obviously they got the two goals. And once it goes into extra time and you've got your two strikers off the field, you just got to get awfully to a penalty shootout, and that's what happened, and obviously lost it. But I still don't understand where you got the 5 minutes from. And funny enough, the referee in that game, Mark Halsey, when I went up to Bolton, a referee was assigned to every club, and so they would turn up and train and get fit, and he was the referee. So obviously he turned up to Bolton, and there's the Man City referee is stood in the canteen. He's like, what are you doing here, type things. So I'm straight away, I'm on him and giving him a stick about the 5 minutes.
He's tripping him up in training, really.
Well, he used to turn up, he was a goalkeeper, and he used to join in the goalkeeping session. So I said, right, I'm getting goal, I'm taking shots past you. So I was nailing shots at him left, right and centre.
Did he ever give you a suitable explanation for the 5 minutes?
No, he's adamant that the substitutions and the time waste and whatever, it was 5 minutes, and I still, like I say, I did give him what for, because obviously he was still quite raw in my mind.
Yeah.
A year later, did you do anything different before the game, or was it a case of, look, we were almost there before, let's just do the same?
Yeah, I think the year later, we just drew down by that experience we had, you know. But that, again, that was another up and down final. We went in the lead, then the guy got sent off against me. He's come. I think was he called Sharp? Was it?
It was the tackle on me, wasn't it?
Obviously, I've just read him coming in, and he was just being booked. So that changed the momentum, and then we end up giving a penalty away, and all of a sudden you find yourself 2-1 down here. It's like, what the hell, what's going on? And we got that late equaliser by Steve Butler, which is a great header, and then obviously in the extra time when Tomo makes that unbelievable diving header, you know, I was right behind that, and just to see it go in with the emotion and the raw, like, wow, it's our turn type thing, you know. I was stood there a year ago and watching Man City get the trophy, and it was, you know, and just to have that walking up the steps and to have that, it was amazing, and the scenes afterwards were fantastic. And I always remember the open top bus as well, as we were going round Rochester and round the streets of Gillingham. It was brilliant, and the fans came out and paid obviously massive numbers, and it was brilliant
to be part of that sort of occasion. As you say, absolutely fantastic. And it wasn't the last dual side that you were part of that went up through the playoffs, but that side in 2009 when Stimson was in charge beat Shrewsbury in the final, but you weren't involved. How did that compare?
I mean, again, being a Gillingham fan and a player, I mean, obviously very, very disappointed to be told, like, an hour before the game that you're not involved. Bear in mind, I was pretty much captain all the way through that season. And to be told that, I mean, the manager makes his decision that he thought Albert Jarrett was a better option on the bench than me, and I turn around, obviously, with my experience and the amount of goals I'd set up and assisted, I think I would have been more useful on the bench. But obviously it was his decision, and you got to just get on with it, you know. And I was disappointed, and I had the family there, everyone was disappointed, but the main thing is Jules, we got the win, and got promotion, and obviously I end up leaving to go to Dover at the end of this next season, but I'm down there with Andy.
Into another playoff campaign eventually.
Yeah, another one again. I mean, that was a great team, I've got to say, when we went down at Dover. We had a great footballing mentality. We played a diamond shape, and just the players wanted the ball, and to obviously have the playoff final against Woking, I think it was. We were 1-0 up away to Woking and ended up losing 2-1. So we were losing 2-1 second leg. And the second leg, I think we've hit the crossbar 3 or 4 times. And how we never won that game and got through that, I'll never know. And obviously Woking, I think they played Bath City, and Bath City end up getting promoted, which we beat Bath City twice over. It's strange how it works, but it's knockout football, isn't it? It's one off.
Did you find it easy to make the transition from playing league football to going non-league with Dover?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I've got to say, because I went obviously part time, ended up getting a job as a labourer at over on the Isle of Grain, actually working as a electrician's mate, and really enjoyed it. It gave me that other side that you've never seen. Obviously, being a professional, you don't really see what's beyond your world type thing, and to go and see just regular people turning up for work 6 till 5, whatever it was, 7 o'clock. And there's some characters on building sites, I got to say. And I really enjoyed it, and I would never swap that again, because it does ground you and makes you more hungry to actually to get back to the levels and get back where you were. And but I went there, and like I say, two years later from Dover, ended up back at Gillingham, as working with Andy again.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because we had Franny Collin on the podcast previously, and he's been a part-time footballer and had that kind of lifestyle with day job and then playing football. I guess you probably wouldn't have needed to go out to work. You could have just sat at home and then played your games and done your training, but you felt that was what you wanted to do.
Yeah, I did, and I wanted to go and do that side of it and see what it's about, because obviously being a pro since the age of 17 right through to the age of 37, 38, you never see it. You've got your job, people have got obviously their jobs, and it's almost like somebody playing non-league and then end up being professional. It's going to be roles reverse type thing. But listen, it was eventful, and I enjoyed it. Do I want to go back to it? No, obviously I'm happy now. Obviously back working at Dover again. It's amazing how things seem to go around.
And between then and now, you went back to Gillingham, you had a couple of years there, but you did have a stint as player manager and your first taste of management with Whitstable in the Ryman League. How do you reflect on that little period of your career?
Yeah, obviously when we both lost our jobs at Gillingham, a good friend of mine, Justin Lutchford, was manager at Whitstable, and basically I'd been first team coach and assistant with Andy at Gillingham. I just want to go and play football again, because that is me. It's a long time when you give up. So I went obviously down to Whitstable again. It was part time, and but I went and worked with Justin, and he was a great guy, great character, and he ended up losing his job, and I ended up just taking a job on, and again, it opens your eyes at that level. It's difficult, I was doing a kit and doing players' trappings, being a player manager, dealing with everything that goes on, driving a minibus to Eastbourne away. It's hard, and eventually it just gets on top of you. And at the same time, the budget was getting cut. I had to tell players that you ain't going to get paid this, and I just had enough, but we had a really good run in the FA Trophy, and the club made a lot of money and a good publicity for the club. We end up getting beat off Ebbsfleet, and obviously we might have been at the game at the time, I don't know.
Cross that went all the way in,
so exactly, it was just the fullback, wasn't it? That was in the 93rd minute. I've just floated across.
Stormer, yeah. Couldn't quite keep that one out.
Yeah, we were 1-0 up, and obviously got the replay. We got beaten in replay, but I mean, they're great days, and great for the fans. And it was a good crowd, I think, that game as well. And again, the pitch was very difficult. So sort of was a leveller, but to go three games from Wembley, it was great, for a tiny little club like Whitstable.
Yeah.
Did you think long and hard before you actually took the manager's job at Whitstable? Or was it something that, well, I might as well give this being the number one a go because I've been a number two before?
Not really. It was just I was there. Obviously, it was easy for the transition for the players. I was obviously being the most experienced and the levels I played at. And I wanted to, obviously, I was assistant with Andy, so obviously I know how things work, and it's totally different. You're looking at a league club like Gillingham, and then you go to a Ryman South club like Whitstable. It's just miles and miles apart, and the standards. Obviously, you're trying to put your standards and your professional on the players that you have, and the crop of players that you have, and sometimes you just
too frustrating for you.
It was. I was frustrated because you just don't. You didn't mean to be, but you just wonder what passes the sea and why they're making these decision making. I mean, why you're out on a Friday night if you get told about it, you're turning up. I've never done that as a player, and then you turn up and you see players smelling of booze. And I was like, really, I don't need this. You know, it's hard enough as it is.
And you had 4 years in the end at Maidstone working with Jay. What did you learn during that time? Because you had success straight away, really, with back-to-back promotions.
Yeah, I've got to say, I mean, I really enjoyed that time. If you can enjoy getting back-to-back promotions and staying in this league for 2 years in a row, you'll never. I mean, the fan base was magnificent. And it's funny, I'd spoke to Jay, but never really spoke in person or had a beer with him. We didn't know each other, knew of each other, but we hadn't met before type thing. So to go in there, I mean, I just left Whitstable and I got a phone call literally 2 days before the season started, and would you want to come as my assistant? Obviously, yeah, I went and met him for the first time and we spoke and had a beer and obviously ended up joining, and I loved it. I loved every minute of it, and to get promotion that first season was brilliant, and we just got some great characters, some great players. We had a lot of players come through, but that was very much based on that team spirit. You know, we had the likes of James Rogers and Franny in there. It was just fantastic. Alex Flishers, Steve Watts, you know what I mean, just working with these players. Again, it's non-league, but it was a different level to step up to what obviously Whitstable was, you know.
More professional.
Yeah, exactly. But there was still non-league traits in there, you know, and obviously me being a professional, trying to come in and working with Jay, we turned it around, and we got it going there for a few years. Obviously, beating FC in the playoff final.
How did that compare, that day winning that penalty shootout, compared to being a player that had won playoff finals, to be stood on the sidelines and watching it?
Difficult, really, because you can't do nothing. You can't do nothing about it, you know. You want to be one of them who's taken a penalty. You just didn't want one of your players to be the one who misses a penalty and loses promotion for you, you know. And again, that was a great game. It had everything in it, you know, the drama of the late goal to the penalties. Obviously, FC, the big spenders at the time, and to be fair, we didn't plan for promotion. We had like a plan that it was going to take a number of years, but then all of a sudden it just arrives on your doorstep, and all of a sudden, ooh, well, we weren't expecting that, yeah. But now it's here. Oh, we've got to deal with it. And I think in many ways, probably that the club moved a little bit too fast, of climbing the leagues too quick, because I don't think the behind the scenes was ready for that.
So you think that maybe contributed to why the last year or so,
yeah,
has been a bit of a struggle?
It's caught up. I firmly believe it's caught up. And obviously, every time you avoid relegation in this league, like I say, it's unforgiving. Every time, you know, the bunting should be out there, you know, because it is hard. You know, you look at the budgets, the levels, the standard of the players. I mean, years ago, when we were in the Ryman South and the Ryman Prem and the Conference South, players wanted to turn up to Maidstone to play there because it's a massive crowd. But when you get to this league, players don't turn up because it's the crowd no more. They turn up because it's one thing, and it's wages, money. That's what floats the boat of these players now. They're coming down from league clubs already, and you're talking to players coming down from league clubs who've already been in the league, you know, and they're only there, they're only sat there in front of you because they want the wage packet. It's not years ago we could have signed anyone because they wanted to just turn up because it's Maidstone, 3,000 fans there. We could have had any player we wanted, but once you start climbing these leagues, it's all to do with money and wages and length of contracts, and that is the biggest thing maybe that the club wasn't prepared for quite yet, and hopefully it will be, because obviously it's still got a you know, I mean, it's still in my heart, obviously, Maidstone and things, what we did for the club, and obviously disappointed to see where they are now, but unfortunately things move on, and obviously I'm at Dover now.
How do you reflect on the last season at Maidstone? Because you started off so well, didn't you? But you went on such a bad run.
Yeah, I mean, listen, we had a mentality of Jay, myself, we start quick, we need to get ahead of, we had a points target, a figure in our minds, but we had to try and get ahead of where we wanted to be in terms of our points, especially at the start of the season. We just didn't want to be playing catch up. You play catch up, you never catch up. You know what I mean? It always seems to just be too far to reach. So we wanted to get ahead of where we were in terms of points. We started really well. We had a great cup run. And we had players who changed games for you. You had Zavons and you had Joe Piggott's at the time. Could just nick you a goal out of some anyway, you know. And as long as we weren't conceding, and we always had the players up top. We had the Alex Flishers at the times. You know what I mean? In the early years, could just change games. Franny Collins just changed the whole dynamics of a game. And obviously the club sold it, and you don't replace them, you're gonna struggle. And eventually, that's what happened. We were still creating chances, and the amount of chances we used to create was unbelievable. But we just didn't have that killer instinct in front of goal, and unfortunately, that's what happens. Your biggest part of your budget goes on strikers, unfortunately, and we just didn't replace them. We sold them, didn't replace them.
How tough was that run when you kept, you know, you couldn't buy a win, could you? How tough was that for you and Jay personally? And did you used to sort of, you know, presumably number two, the assistant, you've got to try and support the manager, and he must have found it really tough.
We did. I mean, listen, you used to go home and like take out on the cat, the dog, misses the kids, and you shouldn't do that, you know. And my family didn't deserve that, because you do take it personally, and you do have moments when you think, can we change things? Can we change personnel, shape, whatever? What can we do to affect it? But unfortunately, sometimes you just get in a rut. You play well in games, and you come away scratching your head, well, we've just lost that game. It's like, but then when things are going well, you go, how the hell did we win that game? Like, we've not been in it, and we've ended up winning the game. So it's when you're down there, it's difficult to get yourself back. The only way you can do it is by working even harder. And me as a player, I'd probably work even harder, and I would, just to try and change it. And we did. I mean, we used to meet players, trying to recruit. When you're down near the bottom of the league, trying to recruit players even harder, because do they really want to come in for a relegation battle? So just recruiting is even harder. I mean, I almost bent Gareth Ainsworth's arm off the back of his, round the back of his shoulder, because we got Will de Havilland in, and I don't think he got any sleep, because I was on the phone badgering, you know, we need to defend it, and ended up getting Will de Havilland in from Wickham, and just to stop the rot, and he came in, did really well for us. And same with Stuart Lewis at the time, when we brought him in. Obviously I've played with him at Gillingham, and we've been good mates and know him, and it's the kind of characters that we wanted to bring in to try and give us a boost, really, you know. And we brought them in, Reese Prestige in, these kind of characters in the dressing room. We lost James Rogers, so the dressing room, like, once he goes out, because he's life and soul of the dressing room, James Rogers, and
a really big factor.
I think it is, you know. I mean, we get these characters in there, Stuart Lewis is Reese Prestige, these characters in the dressing room, and and players looking around, you just can't be too negative. You've got to be positive with the players and being around the players. We all get beat and we all lose games, but you've got to try and get the players up and be positive around them. And if the players see you down, then everything's going to be down.
And it must have felt like winning the title once you get survival at the end of the season as well, you know?
Yeah, it was. And and we weren't ever going down, but we just needed a couple of results and we ended up finishing mid-table, just below mid-table, which on reflection, if I think mid's only take that now, you know, but we always felt as if you're chasing your tail type thing, and recruitment, like I say, is massive for any club, and for a team that hasn't got the biggest budget in the world, it's even more important that the recruitment's, because you've got to get it right. And obviously if you don't, obviously you end up where you are now.
Working as closely as you did with Jay for 4 years, working with Andy previously at Gillingham and then again with Dover, you obviously see the stresses and the strains that a manager goes through. Does it take a particular type of person to be a manager, to be the leader of a club, or is it something that as a coach you can kind of grow into, if you see what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, you've got to be thick-skinned. You've got to take criticism, because all the fans are the best managers in the world, and you've got to rise above it. Yeah, like you say, you take criticism, but to be a manager, you've got to have that desire and will to win, because you've got to instill that on the players. And obviously Andy has that. He was as a player. He had that drive, leadership, character. And obviously Jay was as a player. So to have that traits. And you've got to be brave as well as a manager, you know. You've got tough decisions out there, you know. Just by decisions on team selection, players' contracts, renewals, whatever. You've got to have that killer instinct. And the best managers predominantly have got that, and that's why they're at the top.
It's gone full circle for you now. Obviously, you're back at Dover, as you say. I don't know what it is about you, Nicky, but you seem to sort of go through the same clubs, as we said earlier. I know that a lot has been made of this full-time training at Dover now and how quick Hesosi was to implement that once you took over. Is how much of the improvement can be put down to full-time training, though?
It's massive, because it gives you more lead-up time to working on pattern, doing your homework on other teams, leading up if you've got a game on a Tuesday night, so the preparation begins really Sunday, Monday, so you've got them days to work with. So in terms of preparation, it is massive, and it is the way forward. And when you've been a pro and you've been a professional all your life, it's not foreign, and the boys have really bought into it. The boys were doing two nights under Chris, and I've been there myself as a player. You're hanging around all day, or you've been at work, and then you've got to get yourself up to go training at 7, 8 o'clock at night, getting at 10 if you're travelling any distance, maybe getting in at 11. It's not ideal, because obviously fresh minds on morning training is predominantly the best. You're more alert and you're ready for it, you know, and then you can go home, do your relaxation and look after yourself then.
And you spoke earlier about attracting players. I mean, Dover's even further out the way than any other place you could be in Kent, obviously. Is that going to be a problem going forward? And has it been a problem, you know, in your previous time at Dover and now?
I mean, previously it was, because we used to train every single on an evening, and it was at the Crabble. But now we geared our training. Now we've moved up to Kings Hill. We use the sports park there. So in terms of everyday training, you've got players coming out of Essex, Kent, Hertfordshire, so travelling in to there is a lot easier. You're only really going down to the stadium when there's a match on, so it could be once every 2 weeks. So in terms of recruitment in that sense, it's a lot easier, this full-time training and moving the training facilities up to Maidstone or Kings Hill.
Good stuff. Let's have a quick wrap through the weekend's action if we can. Gillingham's FA Cup journey came to an end. 4-1 at Swansea in the fourth round on Saturday. They need to collect League One, their need to collect League One points is back on the agenda on Tuesday night when Accrington visit Priestfield, while Jules make the trip to Coventry this weekend. You confident Nicky Jules can stay up? I mean, they're only a point above the relegation zone.
Yeah, I mean, now the distraction of the FA Cup's gone, I think they really now need to knuckle down and really start focusing on the challenge ahead, because it is going to be a challenge. They need to, one thing that's noticeable, they need to turn the home form around. Away from home seem to generally pretty well in the league, but when I was a player there, we used to make Priestfield a horrible place for opposition to come and play. We turned it into a battle, and I think that's what they need to do, the players, you know. They've got to have that, make that place not an easy place to come and get 3 points, and if they do that, they've got every chance to stay up.
On to National League action then, and not a goal in sight for our teams. Dover's goalless draw, haven't we spoke about earlier, means that Whites are 5 points clear of the drop zone, albeit having played a game more than two of the teams below them. Dover at home to Gateshead, who are ninth on the table at Crabble this weekend. Obviously going there expecting 3 points, weren't you?
Well, what we are expecting is a difficult game. Gateshead aren't an easy touch, you know. They've got some good players there, very young, athletic players. Yeah, obviously we've turned our home form around. We've got a good home record at the minute. It's a game that we want to win 3 points, and we go all out to go and get 3 points. But we know if we're off it, then it's going to be a difficult day, and that's the mentality we're putting into the players at the minute.
An injury time goal ended Ebbsfleet's 5-game unbeaten run as they went down 1-0 at Sutton. They finished the day in 10th spot, 3 points outside the playoff places. Fleet host Hartlepool on Saturday. Maidstone have installed John Steele as their new manager, but there was no quick fix on Saturday. They went down 3-0 at leaders Leighton Orient. Stones have 15 games left to ensure their survival, but are 6 points adrift of safety. They've won just two of their last 12 games. Nicky, you spoke about Maidstone earlier. John Steele, a good appointment in your eyes?
Well, it's brilliant. I mean, you probably get no better manager at this level to try and turn it around. You wonder, and this is the biggest thing, have they left it too late? Should he have been the appointment after Jay left? Yes, or an experienced one at the time? We've worked on a figure, probably 50, 51 points would hopefully see you over the line and keep your survival. So that's for us personally, is Dover. We need probably 6 wins and maybe a couple of draws in 16 games or 15 games left, I think there is now. So you look at Maidstone's challenge, they've got to be looking at 9 wins. When you look at how many wins have they got so far this season, it's a mountain to climb, and it's not going to be easy because they've got some tough games ahead of themselves. So have we, you know. Every game is a battle in this league, and these games that you've got teams around you, the Maidenheads we've got coming up, we just had Havant at the weekend, they're all fighting for points, and it just, you could be on the rough end of a refereeing decision or anything, or a sending off. I mean, we had 2 sendings off the week previously. Yeah, Gomez definitely deserved that, but I mean, Kevin Locker has got sent off for no reason, trying to catch the player falling on the floor, and he thought he pushed him or punched him, and then we end up ourselves for 40 minutes down to 9 men. You know, it's like, at this stage of the season, anything can happen, and refereeing, decision-making, bad decision-making on players' parts can cost you promotions, relegations, vital points at this stage.
It's interesting you talk about the league table now and the points you need, but obviously when you went in at Dover, you had you'd played more games than you had points, didn't you? So at that point, did you look at the league table much then, or was it a case of, well, let's get some wins on the board first before we start seeing what's going to be further down the line?
Not really. You look at the league table, we arrived because of one thing only, Dover's position, and we worked it out, actually. Funny enough, today we're hitting 2 points a game target. I mean, if we'd done that from the start of the season to the end, then you're on the verge of promotion automatic, as well as it should be in the playoff positions. So we've got a target in mind, we know what it is. We just need to back it up now. We've got 2 massive games at home, next 2 games albeit difficult ones. And then we've got obviously a tough one away to Salford. So these next two games for us as a club are huge, especially as a lot of the teams, I think next week, some of the teams are playing in the FA Trophy next week. So we could even go pull further away. And always, like I say, it's difficult playing catch up.
National League South next then, not much luck for our teams here either, as Dartford drew 1-1 against Concord at Prince's Park and Welling went down 2-0 at Billericay. The Wings host Chippenham this Saturday, while Dartford are without a game. Into the Bostic Premier, Folkestone's impressive home form continued. A 2-0 victory against Kingstonian was their 11th straight win at Sheraton Road in all competitions. Tunbridge left it late to sink leaders Haringey, 90th minute winner there from Adem Ramadan, and another late goal, David Martin from the penalty spot, and Margate a home draw against Leatherhead. Into Bostic South East, Faversham held leaders Cray Wanderers to a creditable 1-1 draw, while Herne Bay shocked second place Hastings 4-1 at Winchesfield, and of two goals for Jake Embry in that one. Ashford took advantage to close the gap in third, Sam Corn scoring the only goal at Three Bridges. Standout result in the Southern Counties East was Chatham winning 9-0 against K Sports. Quite impressive scoreline. Nicky, I mean, we have actually gone through a long time here without talking about big scorelines, but I know we cannot let this podcast pass without discussing a big win for Nottingham Forest and a great day for Nicky Southall, rated 10 out of 10 as well, a hat-trick and four assists. And what was the final score?
7-1.
So you had a hand in all seven goals. Tell us about that day.
Still dining out on it now, I think. Well, first and foremost, it was against Swindon and obviously Gillingham connection, and being and funny enough, it was Ife Inara was manager, obviously teammates.
Even better for you. Yeah.
It wasn't, because he ended up getting sacked after the game, so I'm a big part in that. But the game itself, obviously, Gary Megson had just been sacked, I think. Leading up into the game, so we went in there with a little bit freedom. And Gary was very very old school in terms of what he used to do, and I think the Forest way is by playing football, and it always has been through obviously the Clough era and stuff. And so that game was, in many ways, funny enough, leading up into that, on the morning of the game, my daughter, she actually guessed the score. I wish I had a... I'm not allowed to bet, but I wish I had a fiver on it, because she actually guessed the score, 7-1. It was incredible.
And she's still got these hidden talents, on
each other. I know, yeah. Lottery numbers, but yeah. She actually guessed the score, and ended up, like I said, she didn't know I was going to score, obviously, but she guessed what the score would be. And, yeah, I mean, to score a hat-trick, and especially at such an iconic stadium and as the City Ground is, and the fans are magnificent, the fans, like every single game it's like 20,000-30,000 there, and to play in front of them was a privilege, and obviously to get the three goals and to set the other four up was something like I'll obviously take to the grave, you know. And it was a great day and a great win for the club. I think that was probably the one that turned the corner for the club, I think, in many ways. I still get messages now, you know, on private messages from Twitter, like fans reenacting and remembering that day, especially that game, especially.
Have you got the ball at home somewhere?
I've got the ball at home, yeah, I've got the ball. Not in a glass case, but all the players signed it for me. At the time, it was Jack Lester was there, and Grant Ault, and Chris Commons. Some good signatures. James Perch, who went to obviously Newcastle, and still floating around now, playing, doing really well. So yeah, it was a great day, and just to score goals in front of that. I mean, I scored 16 goals for Nottingham Forest in 2 years, which is quite a decent return, and quite a number of assists as well. So I really enjoyed it.
We like to round the podcast up with some quick fire questions. Yeah. You've almost touched on one or two of them just there, but I'll let Steve fire them away for you.
Yeah, Nicky, were you one for swapping shirts with players during your career? And if so, what's the best one that you've got your hands on?
Yeah, funny. Well, I've got loads of shirts. I used to do it all the time. Best one, Gareth Southgate, when he was playing at Middlesbrough. I always wanted to go back, being a Middlesbrough boy, and we end up playing at the Riverside. We do 1-1 in the game. I swapped shirts with Gareth Southgate. I was just desperate for him to win the World Cup because the value of that shirt would have went right up massively.
Yeah, straight on eBay.
Yeah, Craig Bellamy, swapped at Newcastle because that's obviously scored my only one goal in the Premier League, and to score at Newcastle was, and it was such a memorable goal as well. It was like from 25 yards. It was a great goal. I think it got third. I think it got third in the goal of the month. So. And unfortunately, it was when Di Canio scored that worldie volley, you know, from the tight angle.
Oh, yeah.
Didn't you have a trial at Newcastle in your young
days?
Yeah,
I did,
well?
Yeah. I was there. I was a schoolboy there and was there with Paul Gascoigne. And Mirandina was there at the same time. He was the first Brazilian, I think, to be in the league. I was there for... I stayed in Diggs. I was there for a good few weeks because I ended up having to go back to Newcastle for another trial or sign for Darlington, which was a guaranteed apprenticeship. So I ended up taking a guarantee because if I went back to Newcastle, they would have filled that space. So I just didn't want to take that risk. I just want to be a player. And that's obviously, I did that, you know, but just watching Gazza when he was in his heyday was just unbelievable, you know, and to see him train. I always remember I opened the door for him once in a corridor and he just punched me straight in the stomach. I was on the floor and he just picked me up, rattling my hair, oh, you're right, kid, and this, that, and the other way he goes on. But he just punched me. And it's just weird. But he was such a likeable guy and so infectious. Like the tricks and the mickey taking he used to do was so funny. It was mental.
What was the toughest away ground to go to? Was there one place where it was always, you thought, this is going to be tricky today?
Millwall.
Really?
Yeah, Millwall. Obviously, the association with Millwall and Gillingham was, I mean, they don't like each other at the best of times. To go away to Millwall, I remember just collecting a ball near, right where the sideline is, and this little young kid just runs up to me and spits on me. Yeah, and grandfather was just sat there just letting it happen. It's like it was intimidating. We had some great games, I've got to say. I seem to have scored a few goals at Millwall, and it was one of the grounds where I used to one of them. Sometimes you get grounds where you go and you score goals. Bournemouth was another place I used to turn up and end up seem to score goals at certain grounds.
When you walk into an intimidating atmosphere like that, does it get in your head?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, because I remember we were warming up at Millwall and just looking up at the crowd, and I just caught eye contact, and there was a fan just kept doing that to me. He was going to slash me throat. It was like every time I looked at him, he kept doing it. I was like really nervous.
Like, do I know you?
But I was wherever I was during the warm up. I just kept looking up, and every time he just kept making that motion, I'm going to slice your throat. It's like, dear me.
Who was the quickest player that you ever played with?
Playing with quickest players, probably Patrick Adjeman when he was at Jules and Adi Akinbaye, because I used to just leave balls down the side, and it looks absolutely amazing ball, but he used to get onto it and three or four one-on-ones later, he'd score one.
Made it look like a good pass.
Yeah, it did.
And just a final one, have you had one pre-match meal? Is there something that you like to eat before a game or a routine that you go through that you still do now?
Yeah, I was quite a superstitious person. I always had to put my right sock, right shoe first, right shin pad. Right, I always had to be the right one first. But superstitions. I used to just have scrambled egg really for pre-match. I'm pretty basic. I didn't want to overcomplicate.
Brilliant. Thanks to Nicky for coming in. Enjoy the rest of your birthday as well. I mean, everyone obviously would be listening to the edited version of the podcast, but we've actually been talking for hours. It's been really great stuff, and we're definitely going to have you back again, Nicky, because I really enjoyed it. Thanks to everyone who's listened this week. Don't forget you can subscribe on Audio Boom and iTunes, and keep up to date with all the latest sports stories throughout the week on our website at kentonline.co.uk.
The KM Football Podcast. All the latest reaction and analysis from the KM Sports team. Listen every week and click subscribe on iTunes.